The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network
on News Talk.
My next guest, no stranger to you, she has entertained viewers with her portrayal of Joy in her own series, Finding Joy. She's written novels like Hello Heartbreak and I Wished for You. She's now number one on the bestseller list with her first, I don't know if you call it young adult child, I never know quite what the official term is, but youth fiction. The book is The Day I Got Trapped in My Brain. The author is Amy Huberman. Amy, hi.
How are you, Anton?
Young person, yeah.
No, do you know what? That's the easier part. What I find more difficult when I say, oh, this is the first time I've written a kid's book, because I've written adult fiction before, and
that's
then that
true.
Just sounds like you've written erotica.
Well, if it sells.
Anyway, no, this is the first kid's book I've written. So it's for, I'm with Scholastic in the UK, and they qualify it as middle grade, which we don't really have. So it's like 8, 9 to 12. So it's that. It's a very specific little age bracket.
It's fairly challenging stuff for
yes.
that age bracket. And this is not to say that it's not entertaining, but the themes that you are addressing, they are themes of loss and grief and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I never set out to write that story. I wanted to write a funny book. And a fun book, and hopefully it is as well. But you know, the kind of stories I like to write, I guess, have an emotional heart. And as we were developing the story, so with the protagonist is Frankie. She's 11 and 1 month, and she's you know, she's kind of doesn't understand why all the adults think that she, you know, she's lost her spark. And you know, she's like, oh, the adults are just too boring. They just have, you know, they're lost in their own lives. I am actually magic. They don't realize that. They can't find that out because they don't believe in magic. So she can disappear into a world inside her own head with her little brother, where they go on loads of adventures, and she goes there whenever the real world gets too much or too boring. But yeah, as we go on, I don't want to give away any spoilers.
That's the thing. It's actually quite difficult to explain the plot because there's a lot of spoilers.
Without saying anything, but yes, so that we deal with big emotions in it. So it's yeah, trying to you know, there is no linear way to kind of go through that. So
but it's also, you're not just writing about how you deal with big emotions. You're writing with how do relatively young children deal with big emotion,
yeah.
which is different and in some ways more challenging than adults because the understanding isn't necessarily there.
Well, do you know, unfortunately. Unfortunately, kids will have to go through it with grandparents, with other members of their community, their families. And I did speak to a child psychiatrist about that. And we talked a lot about, you know, puddle grieving, about kids, their coping mechanisms. Yeah, where they kind of get lost in a puddle. I guess adults do that as well sometimes. And then your coping mechanism is that you want to play. And play therapy is huge as well, because they need to access their emotions through play. So yeah, I just wanted to make sure that I was kind of, you know, really telling a story to its best ability, and hopefully it may be a help to, you know, access words and feelings and try to make sense of them a little bit more.
Yeah, because I mentioned this in the show the other day, but you know the Kubler-Ross model, and it's one of the things that the Kubler-Ross model is the one that says that you go through fear, anger, denial, bargaining.
Yes.
Yeah, but everybody sees that as a linear progression, but it's not. You bounce back and forth through those phases.
Well, I was advised that is something that just kind of took on, but that is not necessarily, no, it may be how some people grieve, but that is not a manual on how to grieve. And everybody's journey is very different. I think it's just it's probably touching on all the main key emotions that you may go through. But I certainly don't think once you get through the fear stage or the denial phase that's it done.
It's behind you.
No,
done.
Exactly. No. And you know, it can kind of keep coming back to revisit you.
A difficult balance to write, to keep, because you do it very well, to keep the fun being the predominant emotion of the book and the self-expression and the imagination and the crack, but still deal with that. Does it take a ton of rewrites?
Well, when I wrote the first draft, I had a bit of a hiatus. I had babies, and my editor had a baby, and then I reread it. And because my kids were a little bit further on, and those stages change really quickly, I reread it, and I was like, it's too young. The voice is too young. So I redrafted and made everything older, which that was the most difficult part. It's like, how do I capture a language and a voice and an imagination of an 11-year-old? So that did take a lot of reworking. But I wanted it to be funny. I wanted it to be hopeful, because that's the main message.
See,
in it.
I think you missed the great advantage of writing for a younger audience, which is you can lash in a couple of pictures, make it about 75 pages, 30,000 words, and you're out the gap. This is like 400 pages.
It's like 70,000 words. And that's the thing. I was like, oh, do you know what? Writing kids will be easier. It's probably the most difficult thing I've ever written, because it had to be so specific. I'm not writing for me.
And it has to be consistent. As you say, the age has to stay consistent throughout. That's tricky enough.
Absolutely. And the things that, you know, they laugh, the humour and that kind of that world, like the kids versus the adults, which I had a lot of fun over, because that can be our house as well. So I was writing for my kids. It's like, I'm giving this one to you.
Obviously, everybody will assume that it was written as a reaction to the recent passing of your dad, but it preceded that.
Yeah, it did. And it was a funny journey to it. Like, again, I mean, it's a fiction book. It's a story, and it's essentially a story of love. I was inspired by my childhood and my friendship with my brothers. I was lucky to have, you know, a childhood of fun and the just brilliant formative years of play with them. And I've dedicated the book to them. They're my very first best mates. That doesn't mean that we didn't kill each other, but you know, we had a lot of fun together. And he's reading it out on his wrist.
No, the reason I'm looking for, there was a quote that I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Given that it preceded the loss that of your dad, because you've a line in it, and I don't want to give a spoiler away as to who the character is. But there's a line that said, "The armchair he sat on is now extra empty, and the silences in the house without his laugh are doubly more silency, and the hugs without him there are extra less warm and huggy."
Yeah. It was tough rereading the final thing after my own dad had passed away. Because, you know, with writing, there's redrafts, you know, it's sent back to you for proof. So there was a time where I was doing my rewrites beside him, you know, when he wasn't well and he was in the hospice. And, you know, I'm just really glad that he knew that I was writing it, and he was always a big champion of that. But yeah, it was what was really difficult, even though it was cathartic in a way as well, because so many of those feelings were, I guess, latent in me. They were there because it was a slow process with my dad. There wasn't a shock in that. So I guess I was grieving him even before he left, because it was different stages of his freedom, I guess, that he was slowly losing. So that was over a period of, you know, probably 2 years. And then, you know, it sped up towards the last few months. So, yeah, I mean, I was accessing all those emotions. And yeah, how do you move forward when you're not ready to say goodbye? And that's really kind of what, you know, what that book is about. But hopefully the fun. And you know what that is, has inspired me so much, because my dad was always about fun. So you talk about how do you still laugh in the midst of sadness? And that's something I still find myself doing, because it reminds me of my dad, because I can hear him laughing. And I enjoyed so much fun times with him that, I don't know, it's hard to sit in the sadness all the time.
I find, though, that I think there's something different about that process where you know that somebody is desperately unwell and unlikely to get better. It's a different form of grieving, because to some extent there is buried somewhere a resentment of them for not being able to get out of it, which is a thing that is...
Yeah, there's so many layers to it. You're right. And I think there's also this strange thing where you know on a practical level what's going to happen, but your head doesn't go there. My dad was so sick for so long, even in his last few days, I thought he may pull through. And I think that's just a coping mechanism, because I just don't think that's love. That is your the great loves you have in your life. I don't think it's easy to let go. And I even now I go, he was sick for so long. I go, I can't believe he died. That's bizarre. And I can understand that as a denial thing. I mean, he was 84. He wasn't young. He wasn't old, but he was.
Yeah, but that doesn't.
I know. It doesn't. And I think it's just that, it's hard to, I guess, slowly let go like that.
Is your humour from him?
I would say so. I think, you know, our house was always vibrant and fun. And my parents always knew how to, you know, let us enjoy ribbing each other and them. So, yeah, he had a huge sense of fun. And dad was a messer, and you couldn't really have you couldn't have a conversation with him without him joking about something. And, you know, you could always go to he was a great man for advice on the big things. But his day to day was just incredibly funny and charming. And he just enjoyed laughter.
Because this is a thing that you have parlayed into an extraordinary amount of followers on social media. Your capacity to find the quirky or the funny or the witty, whether it be in picture or whether it be in text, you now have on both Twitter and Instagram, you've effectively a good late audience following you on a permanent basis. 500,000 people on each. Like, it's a lot of...
Twitter was the first one, and that just, it was a really fun place initially. It's probably a little scarier these days.
It's not so much fun
It's a little darker. That's why I probably would have more fun on Instagram at the moment. But I think it's a nice place to be able to give voice to yourself, because before that you was only maybe in interviews or so. Listen, and I think it's just, again, finding the fun in the everyday and not taking everything so seriously.
Can you monetize that? Because I was watching Kim Kardashian talk to David Letterman, and during the discussion they were walking around some grocery store or something else, and she said something like, I have to send a tweet. And the reason she had to send a tweet was because somebody was paying her $1 million to say, I like whatever face cream it is. Now, there aren't many people who have enough followers, I would have thought, in Ireland to be able to monetize it.
Yeah.
But you have to be in that wheelhouse.
But sure, there is monetizing on social media. I mean, like, I guess that's the nature of how things have moved. If you work with a brand, there will be probably an expectation if you're following to. So it might not be in those ways. So sorry, I have to send a tweet. But there's definitely, I think it's wrapped up in a package sometimes these days, or not, or you're just expected to kind of, promote your things a little bit. But it's nice to have a balance as well when you can just talk about really inane, silly things.
Yeah, but I always find it interesting from your perspective in terms of the kind of career that you have structured, because you have, you have the social media presence and audience that goes with that. You have the screenwriting, you have the book writing, and all of it is based on your capacity to say, oh, I'll just do it. You seem to live without deadlines. I don't know how you can function that way.
Oh, as in, that is, yeah, I'd say the editors don't love that. Functioning without deadlines.
No, the other thing there's something lovely about knowing I have to be there at 9, I'll be done at 12.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Whereas knowing I better generate a book or I better. Mm.
And actually, that's interesting, because I think and my dad was always like that, say yes and figure out the detail later. And at times everything can traffic jam together and it is insanely busy. And other times it's lovely to be able to exercise both sides of it. I mean, because I've been writing for the last while, I can't wait to be back on a set. So, yeah, it has caused deadlines delays, I should say, because if you go and film something, but I kind of go in and people know that the landscape of it, because it's probably not ideal for publishers.
A nice flexibility, I imagine, though, for balancing family life
and
everything else.
And I writing is lovely because I only ever really write for about 2 or 3 hours a day, unless you're at the final stages, and then it's hell for leather. But I love it because, I get to pick up the kids from school and be at home for the afternoon. So it's nice.
See, 2 or 3 hours a day is reasonable. We were talking the other week to Paul Howard, him of Ross O'Carroll Kelly.
He's just so prolific. I know he has 8,000 books.
5 o'clock in the morning, locks himself in a room, writes for 9 hours day in, day out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so impressive. I couldn't do that.
Did you push him off number one on the bestseller list?
Do you know what? I met Paul. So that's number one in children.
Oh,
so
okay,
I'd say
good.
Paul
so
is number
no
one
out.
For adult fiction.
Yes, exactly.
I met Paul the other day, and I bumped into him in Easton's, and he was buying the book.
Beautiful.
He is such a lovely man.
The book is The Day I Got Trapped in My Brain. The author is Amy Huberman. Amy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Anton.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.